Emeritus Professor of Economics at DePaul University. Michael Miller joins us to talk a little bit about a program that affects half of families with children. And lo and behold, Michael, I think has some good news for us today. Mr. Miller, how are you? Thanks for saying hi.
Happy Friday, John. Yeah, it's great to be on with you again.
I'm talking about the Earned Income Tax Credit, right?
Yeah.
I hear about that. I may have been the beneficiary of that. What is that?
Well, it is a deal that if you have earned income, that would be income from working, and you're low income, and you have children, for example, what happens is the government actually gives you what we would call a negative income tax. They send you more money. You actually pay negative tax rates. You get back anything that you did pay, and then the government gives you some more money as an incentive to keep working and to work harder. And it has been a wonderful anti-poverty program. It is, you know, oftentimes you worry that people do not have the incentive to go to work. And this is one of those cases where if you work, we'll provide the incentive to work even harder and to earn more money. And so it turns out that that when you have this program, children of families that receive EITC, when they become older, they get into their 20s and 30s, they do better than children who did not receive this particular benefit and were low income. They have higher incomes. They have higher labor participation rates. They have lower unemployment rates. And so these are all very positive outcomes.
I wonder why that is. The kid that grows up in a house with a little more cash in its pocket, how does that translate to that kid having a more successful life?
You know, I've talked to several of my colleagues who are experts in the question, in the area of income distribution and poverty. And there is one view within economics that poverty is, of course, a number that has to do with how much money you have relative to other people. But it's also a state of mind. So if you grow up in a household where work is not valued, where you never see anybody going to work, it kind of affects the child in the sense that they believe that they don't have to work, that they can get by and somebody will take care of them. In households where people do go to work, we find that the children seem to absorb that particular lifestyle, and therefore they're more likely than when they become of working age, they will, in fact, see the value of work and join the labor force and try harder to earn income. So yeah. There does seem to be a mindset there.
Seems like you're distinguishing that from, say, welfare. Rather than giving people money, if you earn income, we will give you a tax credit. And that right. might be two different households. So what would that look like? Like, if I make $25,000 and I've got a couple of kids, I'm at the poverty level, I qualify for the earned income tax credit, but I've been paying income taxes all along. At the end
That's
of the
right.
year, I'm going to get back everything that I paid in and then some, like I'll
and
net
then
out
some.
At the
That's
end of the year.
That's how I understand it.
I'll have
exactly
more than $25,000
right.
at the end of the year, thanks to this program.
That's right, and so there's actually the benefit disappears when you don't have earned income, and that's why there was another interesting finding within this particular study was the group of the income quartile most affected was the second quartile, not the poorest people, the people right above the poorest people. And the reason is that the poorest people tend to receive government transfers. Government transfers would be what we would call welfare. And that since that's not earned income, they're not part of this earned income tax credit program.
Hmm.
And you see, even something, you know, a lot of people say that the minimum wage, for example, is a poverty program. And that's not the case at all because it's not targeted. Minimum wage would affect the son of somebody in Kenilworth the same as it would somebody from the south side of Chicago. But the EITC, what's so wonderful about it is targeted exactly to those people who are working and willing to work harder to earn more of a benefit from the government.
Let's pause here and then come back and answer this question for me then. Does that bolster the argument of, say, the governor in Florida or some states which said that we won't give you these federal transfers, we won't give you welfare unless you are working somehow or more demonstrably working to work? Talk to me about that. And for that matter, guaranteed income. I wonder how that compares to this EITC program. I wonder what that says then about some of the more what are viewed as harsh protocols in states like Florida, Michael. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, this idea of, I think the expression they used for many years was workfare, that you would see receive welfare if and only you worked. And I believe it was first passed in the 1990s under Mr. Clinton, along with the Republican Congress. And it was endorsed by both parties, and it was highly effective. The number of people on welfare fell quite dramatically after this particular program was instituted. But, you know, in terms of harshness, it's my understanding that the current work requirements for people receiving welfare were only those who are able-bodied. So, in other words, if somebody has a some kind of disability that keeps them out of the workforce, they're not going to expect them to have to go to work to earn these particular benefits. It's only those who are not, who don't have this desire or this gumption to work when they should be able to work. Why should society take care of somebody who is not going to do, at least try to help themselves? At least that's how I understand the program. So it's not exactly harsh, but it is an incentive for people to work.
It's my word and maybe the wrong one. What about the guaranteed
income? I've heard that from others, by the way.
Fair enough. Just your word. But I think what you and President Clinton and that Republican Congress said makes sense. What about guaranteed income? In Chicago, there's pilot programs. I think Evanston has one, too, where they're helping people. Here's $500 a month just to help you make amends. I wonder if there's any data or if that compares to the EITC.
You know, I believe the first person to come up with this idea of what he called a negative income tax was Milton Friedman. You remember Milton from the University of Chicago, and then he went to Hoover.
Sure, by name.
He was a Nobel Prize winning economist, a conservative, small government proponent, and he believed that we could get rid of the entire welfare state and just have the IRS have this thing called a negative income tax, where there would be you would have a guaranteed level, which would have to be low enough that it did not destroy your incentive to work. It would make sure that no American starved or was, you know, living outside, if not, you know, affected by drugs or mental illness or something, but that every American would have the chance to have food and shelter, but only that. And it would be the IRS would be the one that would take care of sending you essentially this check. And then if you wanted more, which most of us do, of course, then we work for that. We work harder for it. So this idea has actually conservative roots. It's just how the hardest thing about it is to decide what exactly would be the level of income that would mix, that would both give us the outcome that we want, that people do not starve and are not outside, but they don't destroy the incentive to work. And that's really hard to do.
Talk to me a little bit about inflation. You wrote that the perception of inflation is one thing and inflation is another. What are you talking about there?
You know, inflation has gone down, which is great news. And what we all watch, you and me, and in terms of you think of when unions argue with employers, they always look at something called the Consumer Price Index. And the Consumer Price Index is down year over year to around 3%, which is really good news. But if you ask the average American, they don't see it. They don't get it. So we had to ask ourselves, why would there be such a mismatch between people's perception of prices and the actual, you know, and the reported prices? And it turns out that some of this decline in the price levels is due to what are called outliers. These are components of the basket that are used to compute the consumer price index that fall dramatically or rise dramatically, and they will drag the entire index with them. But it doesn't reflect the underlying movement of the indicator. And so that's why economists have tried to come up with something called core or the trimmed mean. There's a bunch of different names for different methods. And it tries to remove the effects of outliers and then ask the question, how well are we really doing when it comes to an inflation? And we do find that when you remove these couple of items that have fallen dramatically and pulled down the consumer price index, that core remains stubbornly high, and people see that. So when they go to the store, they still see those high prices, and that's why they're reacting. And they won't give Mr. Biden credit for getting inflation down, because in their minds, inflation isn't down. It's still a problem.
What is an example of something that is stubbornly high? People know, and the CPI be damned, this looks bad. Is it a box of cereal? Yeah, what are you talking about?
Exactly. It would be something like that. It would. We do find that the ones which tend to explode, go up the fastest and down the fastest, are both food and energy. And so if you look at it purely using the old standard of food and energy, which is called core CPI, it's still stubbornly high. Although, you know, with most places, gasoline prices have fallen, and that's been good.
Yep, yep.
But people do go to the grocery store and they see these higher prices. So these other methods that the Dallas Fed, the Cleveland Fed, they don't focus on food and energy. They focus on anything that is moving wildly, and they take out these wild movements and focus on the core, on the median of what's going on in it. That's where we see that prices have not fallen quite. I mean, inflation hasn't fallen quite as much as is reported in the CPI. We're making progress. We really are. But it's still not quite there.
So that's an argument for the Fed to give us maybe two more quarter point hikes?
That's the problem. You see, if you were to ask the Fed, and the Fed has actually told us this, Mr. Fed, when it comes to what measure of inflation do you use to decide if you're meeting your goal of stable prices, and what they will use is the core inflation index for something called personal consumption expenditures. They focus on this core idea. They remove all the outliers. So one reason we see that the Fed is willing and is going to raise rates probably two more times, in spite of the CPI headline rate being down to 3, is because these core numbers, this underlying trend, still has not been broken. It's still up in the mid-4s. And people see that. It is interesting that the people do see that. They see the core as much as or more than they see the headline rate.
Hmm. I wish you'd been on my show yesterday when I was talking to another financial expert, more an investment advisor. And I said to him that our portfolios are doing better. If you're lucky enough to have a good pension plan or a 401k, if you're buying mutual funds and you're dollar cost averaging, that tide has been lifting your little boat and you're starting to recover. We're about 5% from the all-time high on the Dow. And so while to me, inflation means the cost of a box of cereal tomorrow, it might be more than I want to pay, but I can afford that. But if we kill this bull market that we're experiencing, or whatever it is, it's not going to just affect the cost of breakfast tomorrow. It's going to affect my ability to retire someday. So I'd rather them ride this little nice run we're on and not raise the interest rates two more times. He said, that's my song, but it doesn't sound like Michael Miller's song.
Well, no, actually, that is my song. I think the Fed is wrong. I believe that the Fed should stand pat, and the reason, there are two reasons. There's a reduction in liquidity in the banking system. The banks are reducing their willingness to lend, and I think that is part of what will keep inflation under control. And secondly, monetary policy takes two years to be fully in place. And so there's all kinds of slowdown yet to come based upon the increases that they've already done over the past 2 years. I think the Fed should sit pat. I'm just telling you why the Fed won't. The Fed won't because the CPI core index is still stubbornly high.
Well, you got some free time on your hands. Why don't you become a Fed governor and throw your weight around a little bit?
Yeah, I wish I could. I wish I could. But nobody listens to me, except you once a month or so.
I do. And we always enjoy it. Michael, thanks for visiting with us again.
Oh, it was great as usual, John. Take care.
Michael Miller is a professor emeritus of economics at DePaul University. Sarah Foster is an analyst at Bankrate. Here's kind of a no-surprise headline. 73% of aspiring homeowners cite affordability as their primary obstacle. Well, sure, Sarah, they're not giving houses away, but there's more to your reporting than that. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
Great to be back here. Thanks for having me.
So talk to me a little bit about this survey from Bankrate. What did you ask? What did you find?
Yeah, so we found actually kind of zooming in on younger Americans here, because we know that they are the ones who have been struggling to really crack into the housing market. We found that 82% of Gen Z and millennials say that they'd be willing to take a sacrifice to be able to afford to buy a home. That's even more than the 61% of Gen Xers and baby boomers combined. And when you look at the reasons why, something that really stood out to me is we asked people what they consider part of the American dream. And younger Americans, at about two-thirds of them, say that owning a home is considered part of the American dream.
So they'd be willing to sacrifice. I wonder what you mean by that. I mean, that means saving more money, spending less, right?
Well, actually, we're talking about kind of the home buying steps that maybe when you think about kind of your housing checklist, maybe you'd be willing to not check all of those boxes off just to be able to afford to buy a home. So what we found is that actually younger generations say they'd be willing to take steps that include anything from moving out of state, buying a fixer-upper, downsizing, even living with roommates or additional family members. I think it really all kind of goes back to those long-running challenges. I consider younger Americans really part of the perennial home buying underdogs of, you know, this current market that we have.
Yeah, and my observation when my wife and I bought our first house was we were early in our careers, we were younger, we saved some money, we eventually came up with a down payment. There was some sacrifice, but I'm wondering how that sacrifice is different than what you're saying now. I guarantee you that my generation, several years ago, we weren't talking about some of the things you just listed. Nobody was talking about moving in with their parents to save money for a down payment, just as a for instance. And interest rates were pretty high back then, too. So it does seem like something is different now than it was then.
Yeah, and it is an interesting point. I think when we talk about, when younger generations kind of talk about, I've done several studies where they feel like they've been left behind in this economy, more to a greater degree than older generations. But that's not to say that older generations haven't faced their own share of challenges. I mean, even back in the 1980s, for example, we saw mortgage rates reach levels that they haven't hit since. But what I think is kind of setting this housing market aside, and it's really impacting everyone, meaning even older generations as well, is the fact that you're hit with this perfect storm of a housing market. Mortgage rates aren't doing anything to really solve the inventory crisis. In fact, they're actually making it a bit worse. And at the same time, home prices are still elevated. And so for those first-time home buyers, it's particularly challenging for them to crack into the market because they likely don't have equity that they can fall back on as the way that other individuals who already are homeowners do.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I was borrowing money at 11% or something like that, I don't remember there being a shortage of inventory. It seemed like there were homes on the market. We surely found one. But right now, so many people are sitting on 3% loans. They're not going to free up those houses. There just aren't homes on the market, are there?
Yeah, and I think that really is kind of the inventory challenges or maybe even where all of this begins. And there really is a kind of a floor on those on home prices before you can before you solve those inventory challenges. I mean, there's only so low that home prices can fall when there is a shortage of homes on the market. And what I think really has to happen is home buyers have to obviously pick up the pace, or builders have to pick up the pace. And we are starting to see early signs of that. I mean, just a report this week from the Census Bureau showed that permits for housing starts for single-family homes are on the rise. That could show that eventually builders are going to get out there. But until we really solve those challenges, it's going to be a tough decision for Americans who are really mulling over, you know, is it time to crack into this housing market, knowing that home building or home buying is the main way that the middle class has historically accumulated wealth, or should I wait this out and potentially risk myself getting hit with higher rent prices?
That's happening, too. And I'm of a mind that younger people today, well, you describe them as the underdogs of home ownership in America, are also less interested in acquiring the material trappings of wealth, homes and fancy cars that, say, their parents were interested in. They're more interested in experiences. So the idea of having a big, beautiful house and an expensive sofa or whatever else goes with all of that, I've been told, is less appealing to 20 and 30-somethings. Does your survey bear that out in any way?
Well, our survey, I think this is kind of what struck me the most, is that just 6% of Gen Zers and 8% of millennials say that they never want to buy a home. So that's telling me that maybe we've been kind of assuming that younger generations aren't as interested in buying a home as we previously thought older generations were. Maybe that isn't always the case, but I think what you're hinting at, too, is a really important dilemma for individuals themselves. Buying a home is a commitment, and it is a personal decision. And for these younger generations who are struggling to crack into this housing market, what I would really advise them to do is just kind of think to yourself, what is it about home ownership that maybe you're hoping it can solve for you versus renting? And if it potentially might mean sacrificing vacations, experiences, dining out, things that you love fitting into your budget already, maybe it does make sense to try to find different ways to accumulate wealth.
It also seems to me, I'll sound like a boomer here, that if you want to get into the housing market, you have to be willing to buy a house that isn't your dream house, that is not the house that you might even raise your kids in, but it gets you in the game. Now you are building equity. Your second house will be nicer than your first house because your first house has appreciated in value. You're using other people's money, and now you've got more money. And that's at least the theory. It doesn't work out for everybody, but I know, I think there is this expectation, and I'm painting with a very broad brush here, that the home will be something very, very nice. And for a lot of us, the very first home was not very nice. You made the most of it, you sold it, and then you had more money to get that next house, right?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point, too, because we've heard anecdotally that younger generations are kind of skipping over the starter home. This classic starter home is kind of how I'm thinking about, too. It's hard when you're first getting started out to make sure that the home you buy is checking off all the boxes on your list.
Yeah.
And I would even say throughout your entire home buying journey, it's a bit like waiting around for a unicorn. It's just if you're holding out for something perfect, it just might not happen. But I think it is something to keep an eye on, and maybe even potentially these younger generations, if they crack into the housing market a little bit later than older generations, maybe the tenure of home ownership starts to rise, which we've already seen kind of indications that it is.
73% of aspiring homeowners cite affordability as their primary obstacle. It's a story in Bankrate that goes further than that, and it's nice to kind of plumb those depths a little bit with you. Sarah Foster, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Analyst at Bankrate. Let's update you on more business news. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The Sears campus in Hoffman Estates could soon become a sprawling data center. A Texas developer that specializes in data centers has signed a contract to buy the property. Crane says the purchase price hasn't been disclosed. The property near the Northwest Tollway includes 274 acres at 3333 Beverly Road. The developer Compass Data Centers out of Dallas has been building data centers in multiple cities, including Dallas, Nashville, and Minneapolis. A Chicago tortilla maker has agreed to a settlement over unfair labor allegations. The National Labor Relations Board in Chicago issued a complaint in March accusing El Milagro of threatening to fire workers who took part in union organizing. The company chose to settle the case instead of going to trial before an NLRB administrative law judge. As part of the settlement, El Milagro must post notices at five Chicago locations, informing workers of their labor rights and promising not to interfere with them moving forward. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food Time. Here's Steve Alexander.
It's a Mr. Fizz Friday, and how are you doing today, Jim?
I'm okay. How are you, Steve?
Good, good. We'll find out what's on Jim's mind after I thank the Chevy Silverado HD for sponsoring us today. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, Jim Fizzell, gardening guru, what's on your mind?
Garlic.
Oh, I love garlic. What about it?
Well, Steve, you know, it's really interesting. We're at maximum harvest right now, but there's stuff that needs to be planted. And one of these things is garlic. You have to plant the things now. September is about as late as you want to do it. August is best. because you want these things to grow in the summer, grow through fall. As soon as it gets too cold, they'll stop growing, but you still have these tops and you have this root system that's developed. So in the spring, very early, as soon as the soil warms up, they're going to start growing again. So by the time they begin to set bulbs in May and June, you've got a great big plant that's going to supply a lot of energy to these things. And that's what you're looking for. And the way to get these things to be big plants is you work the soil up very well, add some fertilizer, and get it so that it is really finely cultivated, because if there's any lumps in it or stones in it, it's going to distort these bulbs. If you have a very heavy soil, you might consider adding some soil amendments to that down to a depth of 6 or 8 inches. Plant the toes upright, 2 inches deep and 4 inches apart. Make sure they're upright, because if you don't plant them upright, you're going to have a crooked one when it develops. These need water. They don't want to be swamped or drowned, but they do need regular watering throughout the fall. And then in the winter, if winter is wide open, which we've had the last couple of years, and things begin to dry out, get out there with a bucket or something and water these things to make sure that they don't dry out over the winter. Another thing that you need to worry about is root maggots. These are fly larvae. The flies, they lay eggs at the base of the leaf. You can spray all you want for these things. It will do no good. The best way to protect them is to cover these rows when the plants are up with floating row covers, which you can get at garden centers and garden catalogs, or simply with cheesecloth. You need to put it over the plants so that these flies can't get in there to lay the eggs.
Mr. Fizz, Jim Fizzell, from the farm to your belly. Today is National Junk Food Day. Celebrate responsibly. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
We've called on Marna Sargsyan to talk to us a little bit about things happening in the, I think it's home construction sector. She's a Howe's staff economist. Marna, it's John Williams. Thanks for joining us on WGN.
Hi, John. Thank you so much for having me.
So tell me a little bit about your business. What does Howe's, H-O-U-Z-Z, do?
Howe's is a leading platform for home remodeling and design. We have an all-in-one software solution for our industry professionals, as well as tools for homeowners or design enthusiasts who want to upgrade their homes from start to finish. So people use Howe's to find inspiration, hire crews, and shop for products.
So would I, is it software I would download and use myself, maybe doing a bump out or adding certain features inside the home?
You definitely will be able to download our app and also work yourself into kind of creating a space within your home through idea books, and also collaborate with professionals if you would choose to.
What's that sector been like? When the pandemic hit, everybody was investing in their homes. Is that still happening now?
Exactly. So during the pandemic, we had renovation and design activity to reach its peak when homeowners were tapping into their savings and upgrading their living spaces. And currently, we are monitoring the industry through our house renovation barometer and looking into the construction industry specifically. What we are seeing is that residential renovation and remodeling activity has been declining quarter over quarter. However, businesses are still somewhat optimistic that things will turn around for the second half of the year. We are seeing that wait times before a pro can start on a new construction project is more than 3 months currently. This sentiment is largely the same for the professionals in the architectural and design sector. However, the wait times there are significantly shorter, averaging around 6.5 weeks.
What's holding things up? It was for a while supply chain. Maybe interest rates haven't been your friend. What are the hurdles right now?
Exactly. A lot of the economic conditions that we have heard before, such as shortage of skilled labor in the industry, is still a top concern. Product and material availability are still keeping our businesses on their toes. Also, economic conditions have raised challenges regarding clients' ability to pay and proceed with their full project scopes.
You did have an air of optimism, though, to your voice a minute ago. What's your forecast? What's your forecast, Marna?
Right. So what we are seeing that renovation and design pros do see that there is still pent-up demand among the homeowners. They are encouraged by the market drivers, such as limited and aging housing stock that requires constant maintenance, remodeling, and redesign. And it makes it more appealing for homeowners to continue with their renovation and remodeling projects. as well as a lot of new homeowners, those who bought their homes in the recent years, who are not completely happy with what they have and are trying to personalize those living spaces and customize for their needs.
One last question. Do you get the feeling there's this floodgate, and when interest rates get below a certain number, it's going to open up and suddenly everybody's going to be swamped?
That's a really good question. We're actually watching the economic metrics really closely, especially with the recent news on inflation decelerating a little bit. So while it's very early for us to comment on that, we're continuing to look into this, and then Q4 barometer might be potentially addressing some of those questions when we see a lot of the projects coming in or the scope of the projects getting larger.
Wouldn't you love to know what that number is? Is it 5%? Is it 5.5%? Is it 4.5%? When are people going
to
jump
really
back
to say, right, it's really hard to comment on that one number.
Well, I won't hold you to that now, but we'll continue to follow it with Marna Sargsyan, who is a House staff economist, HOUZZ.com, to see how they do what they do. Marna, it's nice to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.